Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. Welcome to Admission Straight Talk. Now, if you're thinking of pursuing a PhD, but concerned about the PhD job market, you should be both concerned and you should listen to this podcast because you're going to be even more concerned after the show today. Our guest is a vocal critic of the academic PhD conveyor belt that spits out more PhDs than it can use, saddles them with debt, trains them for positions that don't exist, and fails to prepare them for those that do. At the same time, she has helped many obtain tenure-track positions while being keenly aware of the systemic pitfalls and bluntly condemning the shortcomings of the academy. Why should a podcast dedicated to helping people get accepted provide publicity to such a vociferous critic of the academic system? Two reasons. The first one is that I am a firm believer that you, as a graduate school applicant, should have financially justifiable professional goals in mind when pursuing graduate studies, unless you are one of the few who can afford to pay for and obtain a graduate education for the sheer love of learning with no expectation of return on investment or a job. That's reason number one. Reason number two, I want Accepted clients, visitors, and this podcast listeners to be aware of the challenge they may face if they attend a PhD program. Now, before I introduce our guest, I would like to introduce you to related resources at Accepted, specifically choosing a PhD program, 3 tips, and the name says it all, and plotting your way to a PhD, 6 topics in PhD admissions, which will help you apply successfully to PhD programs. Both these are free downloads written by Dr. Rebecca Bluestein. And we will include links in the show notes to both these resources at info.accepted.com/52, which is a page for the show note to the show, and you can go there after the show is over. Now, let's talk to someone who may convince you that you don't need those special reports because you shouldn't go for a PhD. Let me introduce you to my guest, Dr. Karen Kelsky, who earned her PhD in cultural anthropology at the University of Hawaii in 1996. She served as a tenured associate professor and department head at the University of Oregon and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And since 2011, she is an academic career consultant for her own company, The Professor Is In. Welcome, Karen, to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you, Linda. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Now, what is the purpose of The Professor Is In, and how does it, or how do you, fulfill that mission?
The purpose of The Professor Is In is to help PhD students, ABDs, PhDs, young faculty, hack the academic job search and basically understand in a really pragmatic, hands-on way what is required in an academic, in a tenure-track job application, from reading the job ad to compiling your application materials, your CV, your job letter, your teaching statement, your research statement, and all the way through to the interview, and then finally to negotiations. I also do other help with editing of manuscripts and tenure file reviews and editing as well. Mm-hmm. And recently I have branched out into helping PhDs deal with the non-academic job search as well.
Okay, great. And we will get to the non-academic, but for the academic, what are some of the most critical elements that PhDs need to have if they're going to, as you say, hack it? And the other question that came to mind as you were talking is, why do they have to hack? Why can't they just apply for jobs?
Yeah, good question. Because of the downsizing of the university economy and the wholesale shift to an adjunct-based staffing model, mm-hmm. The number of tenure-track jobs has drastically, precipitously declined over the last 30 years. A real quick statistic, in about 1980, in 1980, about 75% of university professors were full-time tenure track or tenured, and 25% were contingent, temporary, or adjunct. And in the 2000s, that has been completely reversed.
Really?
And now only 25% of the professors on any university campus will be tenured, and 75% will be hired on an adjunct, temporary, or contingent basis. And that has a lot of implications, of course, for your audience, far mm-hmm. beyond the question of graduate school. But in terms of what I do at The Professor Is In, There are now routinely 200, 500, 900 applicants for every single position.
Wow. And so, that makes getting accepted look easy.
It does. It does. And so to wander blindly into your tenure track job search without extremely targeted training in a kind of word by word, line by line molding and sculpting of your job letters and your CV and your record and your whole profile and mode of self-presentation, without that, you are really unlikely to make it through to the level of shortlisting or campus visits.
Got it. How did you come to found the Professors Inn?
This is a longtime obsession of mine. When I was still in graduate school and had just completed my, well, I had just gotten my first tenure track job offer at the University of Oregon, and I had not left Hawaii yet at that time. I was still packing up my apartment to move. I actually created my first job market seminar for my peers in the University of Hawaii graduate program in the anthropology department. And that was the origin of the Professor Is In, and that was in 1996.
Oh, wow.
And every year from that year onward, I gave a version of that seminar to absolutely anybody who would listen. Every grad student I could get my hands on, from my first year as an assistant professor onward, all the way through tenure and being a department head, I would call her and I would deliver my job market sermons. And I eventually even got an endowment at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign to create an all-day retreat devoted to the job market. So
yeah,
this is really an ongoing fascination of mine. It derives from my own first disastrous year on the job market and the shock and the humiliation that I experienced then, and then the wholesale self-education process I put myself through to master, to really hack the market. This was in 96 before the word hack even existed.
It also sounds like it was when the statistics you quoted was this reversal took place in the last 20 or 30 years, you said?
30.
All right. So it was about 20 years ago. So you were already into the decline.
Yeah. 96 was by no means an easy year on the market. But it was a walk in the park compared to the market in 2014.
Got
so it. Anyway, that is how, when I began to become a little bit less enamored with the academic career for myself, it was a real natural transition for me to think about taking the knowledge I had about the job market and the job search and turn that into a consulting business, which I did 3 years ago, and it has been really gratifying and quite successful.
That's fantastic. Good for you. Now, I was on Twitter a few weeks ago, and I think I sent you this tweet, and I guess they call it Tweep, named at iPublicPolicy, tweeted me and said, wrote, quote, "Not sure the PhD degree is good for most students' goals anymore," close quote. How would you respond to iPublicPolicy? Because the specific context, just to, I know I sent it to you, but just so that our listener knows, I had tweeted how to choose the best PhD program for your goals and interests, and he responded, "Reading my Twitter stream, almost no PhD program may be the best program for goals." And I responded, "Then you need the one or two that are good for your goals, or you don't need a PhD." Mm-hmm. And at which point, again, he responded, "From my Twitter stream, not sure the PhD degree is good for most students' goals anymore." Mm-hmm. And I responded, "That is increasingly true." How would you comment on this exchange?
Yeah, this is a really fraught subject. And I wrote a post about it called "Should You Go to Graduate School?" that encapsulated my thoughts on this subject, because I'm asked it absolutely just constantly. Every day I have an email in my inbox, "Should I go to this PhD program? Which of these programs should I go to?"
If you send me a link, the link to this post, I'll include it in the show notes also.
Oh, great. Okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
So basically, I really want to start by saying that I believe that a healthy functioning democracy should have a robust higher education sphere that supports the world of the PhD and the academic career. So I absolutely deplore what is happening, and I don't believe in it, and I'm very sorry to see it happening. I want students to do PhDs if they can do them without financial ruin.
Yes.
And that takes some very careful strategizing, and it will be a different calculation for different people. I think that if you can meet certain conditions, the PhD can still be a good choice. And I will tell you, if you like, I will tell you what I think those conditions are.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. I think that if you can, first of all, have little or no undergraduate debt, if you can get into one of the premier elite programs, which have abundant and full funding, if you apply and get an offer of a full funding multi-year package, mm-hmm. if that full funding package is actually enough to support real human life in the location where the school is located,
right.
for your circumstances. In other words, if you're single and willing to live a monkish life on ramen noodles, sharing an apartment with five other people, and you're okay with that, you'll make one decision. If you have two children and a dependent spouse, you're going to have to make a completely different deliberation. So I'm not making a blanket statement. I'm just saying you need to calculate whether that $15,000 a year stipend that they're offering you for your comp lit PhD in New York City is actually going to support your family or you,
right,
whoever you define
right.
that. And then, let's see. Yeah, those are the main things. And then, of course, when you calculate the financial cost of a PhD, it's not just the immediate cost of it versus your immediate expenses. It's also that you are taking time out of the workforce.
Right.
So there are certain opportunity costs that you are not employed in another position where you're gaining salary and seniority,
right.
and also contribution to Social Security. So,
right.
and retirement.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to make sure, in light of that, I do encourage people to consider their age, and preferably if you can be 30 or under or 35 and under, it is a much safer choice. If you are entering a PhD program in your late 30s, the risks and the stakes are much, much higher if and when you get to the end of it and are unable to find secure employment.
Sure, sure. The opportunity costs are much higher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people in their late 30s as opposed to their mid or late 20s.
Exactly. Many people have to reinvent themselves after the PhD for a different career than the one they ostensibly trained for, because that career no longer exists for so many people. And if you have to reinvent yourself in your 30s, that's one thing. If you have to reinvent yourself in your 50s,
it's much harder. Much harder. Why do you think people are still pursuing the PhD at this point, and the publicity about the risks and the likelihood of getting a tenure track position, I think, are pretty well known out there. Is it just case of hope springs eternal, or is something else going on?
Hope springs eternal. Denial runs.
Won't happen to me.
Exceptionalism. It won't happen to me. This is a problem for other people. And it also has to do with, you know, in some ways, I think that the human race needs to believe that there is some kind of space outside of capitalism, some space outside of the profit motive. There's certainly an echelon of people, and I was one of them when I was younger, who wants to live in the library, who wants to think great thoughts, who isn't driven by a profit motive, and who believes that they would love to spend a life making a very modest income, but having a life of the mind. And we've encouraged that dream for, you know, many, many years. I mean, certainly since World War II in the United States, and the vast expansion of the university
yes.
system in the United States, that dream has been very available and viable for many people.
Well, also much less expensive.
What's that?
It was much less expensive.
Much less expensive, yes. So I think that what you have is a segment of the population that is steadfastly dedicated to the idea that they should be able to do this. Mm-hmm. And they can't let go of it. They just can't let go of it, and I'm sorry that they have to. I wish they didn't have to let go of that dream because I think it's a good dream. I think the world, I'll go back to my earlier point, I think the world needs people who study classics and right. who study medieval French literature and who study an arcane, tiny, linguistic, you know, group on the verge of extinction in, you know, the Arctic Circle. But I believe the cost to the human knowledge and our human welfare is incalculable by the loss of those opportunities to pursue those types of careers. But the fact is those opportunities are disappearing and have disappeared. And you cannot simply make the same kind of career planning based on that arcane, esoteric, scholarly track that previous generations had the privilege of doing.
Right. Now, in your opinion, what are the... Let's say somebody's in a PhD program. You were kind of giving criteria for people to join a PhD program, acceptance at a top university, the financial ability, and I actually forget the third one. What was the third one? You mentioned three things. financial ability, acceptance at a top, maybe there were only two, and then I'm not forgetting.
Well, anything. No undergraduate debt.
That's right. Okay. So that would be who should consider pursuing a PhD. Now, but once you're in the PhD program, what are the key pieces of advice for getting a tenure-track position in academia once you're already in the system or perhaps
Absolutely.
Close to finishing? Yeah.
That is a question very close to my heart, and I would change the question
okay.
From that little thing that you just added at the tail end where you say where you're close to finishing. In
okay.
fact... The best answer to that question is start preparing for your tenure track job search from your first semester in the program.
Okay.
And that is the advice that I gave back in 1996, and it's the advice I still give to anyone who will listen and who will come to my webinars and read my blog posts. But basically, I want people to enter. I have a line in one of my blog posts, don't settle into your graduate program like a hamster in the wood shavings.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep your eyes open. You have to be alert. The bottom line is graduate school is not your job. And the fact that you might be there for 5 years, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years still doesn't make it your job. It is not your job. It is only a stepping stone to your job.
Right.
And so that shift of orientation is absolutely critical. And it should not just happen at the term that you graduate. Because
right.
if it only happens then, it is way too late for you.
Agreed.
So you need to start in your first year in the program and really look at it as a vocational professional training in which, in addition to the courses that you're taking and the scholarly ideas that you're grappling with and the mentorship and that you're receiving, that you're also constantly looking for chances to go to conferences, that you're meeting all the famous scholars who come through your department and getting yourself invited to dinner, that you're going to all of the job talks for every candidate who comes through your department, whether they're in your subfield or not, that you get yourself on the search committee so that you can, you can't do this as a first-year student usually, but, you know, make sure that you participate to the fullest extent in the searches that your department is doing. It goes without saying that you want to strategize for publishing as
right.
soon as you can, as early as you can, and as often as you can in graduate school. So basically major grants, major conferences, publishing, and networking with the people who you can get access to. Those four things are the pillars of professional training, that which you can start in your very first year.
Right. Well, that makes sense. And I've many times said that graduate school is a means to an end, not an end in itself. And I think that a lot of applicants, whether it's the PhD, the MBA, you know, masters of all kinds, they get so focused on just getting in or getting, usually just getting in. They don't even think about what they're going to do after they get there. And that's, I think, a critical mistake, really, across the board. Once you're talking about graduate education. Law
yeah.
school also, for example. That's another one.
Well, graduate school is a very consuming experience. and graduate students, and I know this from my own personal experience as well as watching all of my students, we all in graduate school believe that we're just terribly, terribly busy.
Most people believe they are terribly, terribly busy.
Right.
And my retired mother is terribly, terribly busy.
I know, so is mine. It's really, Karen, I just don't have time for that. You have no idea how busy I am. I'm like, Mom.
That's right.
Anyway, you make lunch. Anyway, and so they will, you know, routinely say, well, I cannot possibly find the time to worry about publishing. And the fact is that you're tremendously privileged in graduate school. You have less to do than you'll ever have to do later when you're actually employed on the tenure track and you're on that treadmill. And this is not really optional. If you're serious about having a legitimate shot at an academic career, these things are no longer optional. And the trouble is, of course, is that a lot of advisors still to this day treat them like they are. And they don't help, and they don't deliver this message that I'm delivering right now. And even if their advisees get this message and come to them saying, oh, I heard from Dr. Karen that I need to do X and Y, how do I do it? They might get told by their advisor, oh, you don't need to do that. Just focus on your dissertation and everything will be fine. So they
are they really that out of touch?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
Less and less.
I think so.
Yeah, less and less are students getting the just focus on your dissertation and you'll be fine. But I think a lot of advisors kind of throw up their hands in a kind of a resignation. You know, they're not ill-intentioned, but they're out of their league. They have absolutely no idea how to advise for professionalization.
Now, I recently saw on your blog that you are now also advising PhDs on how to get non-academic positions, and you said that, you know, earlier in the podcast. I assume the change is in response to the job market and the declining job market for tenure-track positions or the shrinking market.
Yes.
What do you advise applicants? I mean, do you advise them to kind of pursue parallel tracks? If, you know, they prefer the tenure track, you advise people in either before PhDs or in PhD programs to consider non-tenure tracks and prepare for those. What advice do you have?
It is in a parallel mode to saying that when you get to graduate school, you should instantly, from the day you arrive, orient yourself toward the tenure track job search. You can also keep a little window open onto the non-tenure track, the non-academic job search. And if you keep that window open, even if it's just an attitudinal shift, it's going to have an enormous impact on your experiences through those years of grad school. And you're going to learn to think about the skills that you're gaining, not just in this incredibly rigid, unilineal, value system that, you know, where only the tenure track job offer outcome is valued, but rather you begin to accrue these skills with a much more flexible, open-minded optic on, well, this could be mobilized in this kind of world and that could be mobilized in that kind of world.
And this could be satisfying. This could be personally satisfying.
Very satisfying and much better pay. So in most cases, it's really important. The most important, I delivered really two primary pieces of advice about PhDs thinking about the non-academic job market.
Okay.
And the first is really, it's a little wooey. It's a little, maybe Deepak Chopra.
Okay. new agey. Okay.
Yeah, it's a little bit about, what it's about is shame. It's about shame.
Okay.
Basically, if you've been successfully indoctrinated into your PhD program, you have adopted, consciously or not, that value system that, and of course, I'm assuming that you are in the humanities or social sciences. That's the bulk of my audience. I know that your audience are often going into MBAs and law school and medical school, and they live in a different world, where living in the real world and not being a tenure-track professor is a very, you know, very fine option.
But if we also have a lot of people in the STEM fields. And they may not be.
STEM is tricky. STEM can go both ways. Some STEM folks are very comfortable out in industry, and some STEM folks are very invested in the scholarly career track. So, so I'm really addressing myself now to the people who are invested in that scholarly career track. That you, if you've been successfully indoctrinated into your program, you have accepted this value system where if you get anything less than a tenure track job offer, you are a failure, and you will put that judgment on yourself. Your colleagues will put it on you. Your advisors will put it on you. And it's going to be absolutely debilitating. And I know this because I've watched it in so many people. I've read about it on so many blog posts. But I also experienced it myself. And I left academia voluntarily after a completely successful career. And a really good set of reasons for needing to choose a different path. And even leaving from this place of strength, I still felt absolutely debilitating, crippling shame about my quote-unquote failure for at least a year in which I was so profoundly depressed. Yeah.
Wow.
It was terrible. And so I know how debilitating this is and how much this shame function can stop people from making proactive choices to protect themselves and to advocate for themselves. The shame function is why so many people end up the victims of adjunct exploitation. Because they can't give up the dream. They can't give themselves permission to say, no, enough. I deserve something better. I will not do this anymore. So that's the first piece of advice. Well, it's not exactly advice, but it's really just a be alert to how shame is corrupting your thinking process.
Okay.
And then the second piece of advice, which is really common on people who do post-ac and non-academic and alt-academic advising, is that you have to start thinking, you have to distinguish your skills from your identity. We live in an identity-based field where you are a professor, you are a scholar, you are an academic, you are a specialist in medieval French literature, and that's your identity. But that identity doesn't work anywhere outside of the academy. So you have to disaggregate your skills from that. Well, my skills are that I am an accomplished grant writer. My skills are that I am excellent at qualitative data analysis. My skills are I'm a tremendous organizer. I have organized a series of conferences. So you have to get used to thinking about those skills and how those are differentiated from others who might be your competition for these jobs.
And how those skills might be valuable in different fields.
Exactly. Exactly. That they PhDs routinely think that they have no skills that are useful outside of the academy, but actually PhDs have tremendous skills. I mean, for one thing, the tremendous self-discipline that the average PhD has, the resourcefulness, the ability, the self-motivation, ability to keep digging away at a complicated project day after day after day. The writing skills, the editing skills, the verbal oral presentation skills. Academics have a great command of many, many different types of software and computer programs.
Also, very much
various things.
Data focus.
The data focus. Yeah, absolute languages. Mm-hmm. we have an enormous in anthropology where I come from. So many people have statistics skills that they don't really value very much. But in fact, one of my former PhD students who has one foot in the academy and one foot outside of it and is about to probably have both feet outside of it very soon, she just sort of fell into creating a little business doing statistical analysis because she was used to be helping her friends who couldn't do it for their classes. And then pretty soon she became so well known for the help she was giving that people started to offer her money. And she started to take the money, and before she knew it, she had a business. And she's a primatologist. So
just before you came on the call, I was looking at an article called "Big Data, Big Paycheck: Median Salary for Analytics Professionals and Those Specifically Within Data Science." This is in the Wall Street Journal today. Get familiar with big data now, or face permanent pink slip. Demand rises for analytics professionals, data scientists. I just, it's today's Wall Street Journal.
I'll check that out.
Yeah, today, as we're recording this, it's April 9th for any listener who hears the conversation. But yeah, I mean, it's just like, just before you came on, that's what I was looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of directly germane. So these kinds of skills are something that PhDs tend to have, and they're very much sought in the marketplace outside of the academy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you do have to gain some of the tricks of the trade of articulating those in ways that non-academics will be able to A, understand, and B, respond positively to. Because academics, we speak a code. I do always call the academy a really benign cult. and we speak a language that is so wonderfully comfortable to us as insiders, but is impenetrable to outsiders. And in fact, it's alienating and annoying. We sound like, you know, pretentious jerks, I think, to a lot of the world, and with our incredibly complicated syntax and vocabulary.
Multisyllabic words.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, speaking in paragraphs when we could be in when a sentence would do, or a sentence when a word would do. And so I do know that academics have a high learning curve when it comes to reframing their material. That's actually why I've hired a panel of experts at the Professor's Inn to assist me, because I am a person who still works to a large extent in the academic idiom. I'm still very comfortable in it. And so I wanted to make sure I had experts who were living and working out in these different fields of government or nonprofits or corporations to be able to do that translating work for my clients.
Right. That's funny. I recently attended, it was like a graduation ceremony. And they were honoring there somebody who was about 90, and he was on the dais, and it looked like he was sleeping. Okay, you know, little old man, white hair, white beard. And the person who spoke before him was very, very intellectual, spoke for about 45 minutes, just kept going on and on, lots of multisyllabic words, very highfalutin. My son asked me afterwards, did you understand it? And I said, no. Did you? He said, no. and then, you know, people were polite, but everybody was getting pretty antsy. And then they introduced this 90-year-old honoree who woke up or got up, shuffled over to the podium, and in 2 minutes had the audience eating out of his hands.
Oh.
He was great. He spoke to the people. He spoke their language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no less profound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But of course, I couldn't tell how profound the first guy was. But anyways.
Yeah. Yeah. In academia, you're rewarded for being arcane and esoteric, and
maybe obtuse.
And obtuse, and especially in parts of the humanities. Yeah. Really, you sacrifice your prestige if you use simple, accessible language. Right. And so that's an enormous barrier to PhDs being able to communicate with the outside world.
That's true. With mere mortals. What non-academic industries are hiring PhDs in significant numbers these days? Is there anything in particular, or does it again depend whether it's STEM or non-STEM, social science, humanities? Is there any?
I have a special attention to where anthropologists are ending up, who seem to be in the news a lot. There's several anthropologists who've written high-profile stories about ending up at Google and
really?
and being at different corporations where they're turning their marketing type offices and corporations where they're turning their ethnographic abilities into basically market research. And so that's a huge area that someone with ethnic, like a sociologist or an anthropologist, could go into, because these skills that they've spent years mastering are just critical to effective on the ground market research. I know that folks in anthro, soci, and also linguistics can do a kind of a semiotic analysis that's very popular in the world of PR and advertising, where they help to both interpret and develop signage and language and trademarks and, you know, imagery. Yeah, it works symbolically. It's basically symbolic analysis on how the symbols appeal to or not appeal to their audience. So there's some interesting directions that are not necessarily, they're a little bit counterintuitive, but that people can go to. And then I think that one of the, panel of experts, it has been working as a trainer at 7-Eleven for many, many years now.
Really?
And she's an English PhD, but she basically got started doing technical writing and technical writing editing.
Yeah.
And little by little then began, as she got her foot in the door, began to train others to do technical writing, and then went from training others to do technical writing to just training others. And now she is, I don't know her exact title, but she's a very high up in 7-Eleven, heading their training division. And so I think one of the things about the non-academic job search is that it really, even more than the academic job search, it depends on this kind of networking and this kind of keeping your avenues open to opportunities that come your way. So the academic job, and that's actually another barrier that academics have, is that we expect to see our jobs advertised in the Chronicle of Higher Ed or interdisciplinary newsletter website, and boom, they're all there. We can say with total certainty, there were 9 jobs advertised in my field in 2013.
But there might be 900 people looking for them.
Exactly. And the rest of the world doesn't operate like that. The rest of the world is much more chaotic and opportunistic, and based on who you know, and did you have a conversation with someone at the right moment that inspired them to think, wow, I think you could really help my company. So So that's another, another way that the academic training has to be kind of jettisoned to some extent as you try to reorient yourself to a different type of job search.
Right, that's an excellent point. I think, two stories. One, I know when I was in college, which was a long time ago, but I don't think the mentality really has changed all that much, especially if you are in the academic world. I know I thought, I was a child of immigrants. You become a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant. But accountants weren't so popular then. Basically, it was doctor, a lawyer, and maybe teacher. And, of course, that was the heyday of the academy. So that was another option. But the truth is that there are so many more opportunities out there. And then there were also then, maybe not as many as today, but certainly enormous variety and combinations and you know, niches and... It's infinite if you just are open to them, and I think if you do a little research ahead of time, or as you say, allow yourself to be aware of emergent opportunities, which is a term I just heard of, I just read in a certain blog post recently that I thought was a very interesting blog post. Emergent opportunities, I think that's something that's real important. And I'm as I said initially when I started, I think it's really important that you start your graduate education with a postgraduate professional goal that justifies the time and the cost of the education, unless you are independently wealthy and can learn for learning for education's sake. Yes. You have to have that goal in that direction. But at the same time, you can balance that goal in that direction with an openness and a flexibility to emergent opportunities and just changes in the job market.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And to your point about networking, my husband is an actuary. He was trying to help a young actuary kind of get his foot in the door. And he forwarded his resume to a colleague, former colleague. And the colleague wasn't that impressed and ignored it. And he, through a different means, he ended up getting an interview at this company. And then he had... In a social sphere, entirely non-professional social sphere, he had lunch with the person who was making the hiring decision at somebody's house. And she had prepared an offer letter for somebody else. But upon meeting him in the social setting, she said, this is the guy I want to hire. She'd interviewed him. I thought she'd reviewed the resume. She said, this is the guy I want to hire, because she met him in a social setting. Yeah. So as you say, the chaotic element, the opportunistic element is really alive and well in a job search.
And that's maddening for academics. They have to, you know, and I'm super sympathetic.
Well, that guy was pretty happy. Not the one who didn't get, the guy who didn't get the offer doesn't know what happened, but the guy who got it.
Exactly.
But it was just a
I don't want to leave this subject. I don't want to leave this topic, though, without saying something that I feel is important from a social critique perspective, which is that our society as a whole, our economy as a whole, and our has shifted to an ethos of precarity, meaning a rejection of security, a rejection of job security, and an increasing reliance on people who are hired on ad hoc, impermanent, temporary bases. And so many people, you know, very much alive in the blogosphere about the alt-act, non-act world is the sense that you can't just say to someone who has a PhD, well, go do something else, and that there, you can find another job. Everybody's struggling. Everybody in every sphere is struggling to find good jobs that pay a living wage, that carry benefits, and that have security for future employment. And so I really don't want to just, you know, paint a picture where, you know, if you just leave the academy, everything's going to be fine. Everybody is struggling. That's why so many college graduates end up living at home with their parents now, you know, just departing from a time-honored American cultural model of independence. I used to teach in my intro to anthro class about how America was based on the model of independence, where you went to college and never went back home. And now if I had to teach that class again, I'd have to change that lecture because of the economy. And so it becomes all the more important that you be really alive and try to allow yourself to become more comfortable with the unpredictable, chaotic elements of job searching in this era of precarity.
I would also I don't care what field you're in, I'd give, unless perhaps government, I'd give up on the concept of, you know, lifetime job security. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist. It really doesn't exist in corporate America.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to find in academia. Very, very rare. Outside of government, I think.
Yes.
Is there anything applicants can do before they start a PhD program to better position themselves for careers either inside or outside of academia? So there's really two questions in that question. Again, this is a podcast for applicants. Some of the listeners, most of the listeners, are not yet in a PhD program.
Yeah. I think that the best thing that anyone can do at that very, very early stage before you've even started is to educate yourself, is to read really widely. It is depressing. And I know that people resent it sometimes. In fact, there's another genre of writing out on the blogosphere from undergraduates who are really resentful of the constant, you know, negative Nelly, perspective from people like me and William Pennypacker, and who are like, don't go to graduate school. And they're like, I have a right to go to graduate school. You cannot tell me what to do. You're not the boss of me. I appreciate that perspective. And like I said, I really encourage, I really support people's desire to go to graduate school.
Well, I definitely support their desire to go to graduate school.
Yeah. I just don't want them. I don't like to see people go in the grip of delusion. That's what I don't like. And of course, when you're only about, you know, in your early 20s, you know, and I say this completely without judgment and with a great deal of affection, but delusion is kind of a way of life. But to the extent that it's possible,
the question is: Do we stop diluting ourselves as we get older? That's another question. But anyways, go ahead. I'm sorry.
But I think it goes hand in hand with the idealism of youth. I mean, we need youth to be idealistic. We do, absolutely. Yes. It's critical. It's critical that people believe things are possible. And people believe them that things are possible the most when they're the youngest. And so that's really important. The trouble is when that idealism gets corrupted by seducing people to make what are what can be financially ruinous decisions based on false information, misinformation, and they make decisions that mortgage their future to the bank through this indebtedness, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt out of a kind of a misplaced idealism. You know, that I have a right to study classics. Well, you do have a right, but you may not have enough money. And
right.
So basically, if you can just really walk in with balancing your idealism with an understanding of what this is really going to cost you, and don't allow yourself to be misled by all of the forces who are trying to mislead you. And of course, the lenders, the predatory student lenders, are the worst. But so are, in a way, and I hate to say this, so are your professors. And in fact, I was in an interview recently where I was talking, and the interviewer said to me, Karen, it really sounds like what you're saying is that professors are basically the cigarette companies of the academic, you know, of the academic sphere, because they're feeding you this stream of misinformation.
It's addictive too.
Right. And in a way, professors are kind of the cigarette companies. They're not telling you the truth about what the implications of these years in their programs really are for your long-term physical, mental, and financial health. So be very skeptical. Do your homework. Make sure you have a sense of how fast can I get out of this program? How cheaply can I get out of it? And what can I do with this at the end in terms of employability?
Okay, great. Karen, I think we're just about out of time. Where can listeners learn more about your work and The Professor Is In?
Well, come to theprofessorisin.com.
Okay.
And I have an ongoing series of new blog posts every week, and I offer webinars on almost a weekly basis on different topics related to graduate school and the job search, or just email me at gettenure@gmail.com.
Sounds good. We'll include a link in the show notes. Karen, thank you so much for being here today and sharing your experience, your perspective, and your knowledge of the PhD job market and the whole gestalt. We'll include, again, we'll include a link in the show notes at info.accepted.com/52, both The Professor Is In and to the accepted resources I mentioned earlier. And if you get me a link to that blog post that you mentioned earlier in the podcast, I'll also include that. Listener, thank you too for joining us for our 52nd episode. If you found this episode valuable, please share your feedback. 5-star reviews on iTunes are particularly welcome. You can leave any kind of feedback on iTunes, the blog, or by emailing lynda@accepted.com. And if you're not yet a subscriber, you can subscribe either through iTunes, Stitcher, or Zoom. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Lynda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.